This piece was brought to you by Roberta's, robertaspizza.com.
I'm Dave Arnold, host of Cooking Issues. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Eating Disorder. I'm Paul Gerard. Please welcome my co-host, the Reverend Spiro.
What's up?
Crazy Legs Conti is not with us today.
What's up, brother?
He's jet-setting international. He's showing his short film in London tonight, or tomorrow, maybe.
Yeah, I really wanted him to be at a haggis competition. Like, just like, how much haggis could Crazy Legs eat?
More beans. I just see him chowing down 10 English breakfasts in about 2 minutes. Our other co-host is a competitive eater. He actually makes a lot of money. This is actually a pretty cool show tonight. We're very excited to have some native New Yorkers in the studio with us. We have Mr. Jesse Mallon.
Hello.
And Danny Sage from D-Generation.
It's the first time you got us. We haven't done anything like this in probably about 15 years.
Really?
Really?
Maybe longer.
We've
done shows, but we haven't sat like this and done anything like this.
I'm getting the fanboy chub. I am.
We decided to come back big. Go further than Williamsburg.
Mom, do you hear that? That's what we got.
Eating Disorder on Heritage Radio. You heard it here first. But yeah, at least now you get to hold on to the cans like you're singing back up for a Journey.
Yeah.
We did this great one actually a couple of years ago when we were out on the road. I don't even remember where it was, but it was something. I think it was on. You could see us as well as hear us, but there was some kind of little bit of a time delay, and people were calling in with questions. It was just really awkward.
Oh,
you don't remember that?
Some of our
Westwood radio.
It was in LA or something.
Yeah.
Burbank, California.
Listen to some of our old episodes. It's just like,
We talk like that anyway sometimes.
A friend of mine in New Orleans said, I love your show. I call it four guys talking over each other.
And we're watching people eat, and they're watching us talking to microphones. If you can't see us at home, this is what's happening. We're in the back of a restaurant.
Actually, this is a container. It's a
trailer.
Container. Yeah, it's a trailer.
Yeah, it's a shipping container.
Yeah.
Genius. Why didn't we think of these things?
We're going to ship all these people back to America and take over Brooklyn again.
Just like the old days. Yeah, like I was saying, it's interesting having native New Yorkers on. It's few and far between. You know, I meet people all the time and they say, where are you from? And I say, Brooklyn. And they say, no, where are you from? And
yeah.
I go, I'm from fucking
no,
Brooklyn.
Really, yeah. Brooklyn. No, really. You
know, yeah.
I don't just live here.
No, it's weird when I meet people, and especially in the East Village, and I go through the same conversation, and I say, no, I was, you know, I was born uptown. And I say, yeah, there's three of us left, me, Jesse, and my little brother. And it's like everybody else has been cleaned out.
Yeah, it's amazing. Well, yeah, they can't afford it the way we used to. You know, back then, it was a hell of a lot easier to live in New York.
Dude,
yeah.
I'm a native Brooklynite, and I got priced down at the Queens. Now, I'm loving Queens. I am. I'm fucking loving it. I'm like, fuck it. You know, it's awesome. But at the same time, I feel a little betrayed. I do. You know, to some level, I'm just like, let me get this straight. You paid me to leave fucking Brooklyn?
Yeah.
You know, fuck off.
We both spent a lot of time growing up in Queens. But I was telling, you guys' friends, Dre, like, we had this conversation really seriously. I mean, because I know he's from Brooklyn, too. I mean, I've lived in Brooklyn probably 25 years. But people ask me, where are you from? I never would say Brooklyn. And I've spent more than half of my life there, but yeah. I just don't consider that I'm from there, you know.
Yeah, it's cool, you know. I mean, everybody comes from somewhere, you know. It's like a thing, like you say, oh, I'm from New York, or I was born, if I go back, my family is from the Lower East Side and eventually from the old country, you know, but great-grandparents were on the Lower East Side, and we followed in a lot of footsteps, finding ourselves in the ghetto because of the music. It was cheaper to create and live and find places to rehearse, and you could get away with things that you couldn't get away with in Queens, and And we always felt that New York was kind of its own place, like its own country. Like, you know,
that's some irony that you can get away with stuff in Manhattan that you couldn't get away with in Queens. And now everybody's going to Queens.
Yeah.
Right.
And everywhere else that you can't get away with shit in fucking Manhattan anymore.
Right. Yeah. Well, Manhattan's like this tourist built, you know, obviously, you know, it's just like a big mall chain store thing. But I just feel like, you know, you come from wherever you come from, you go and do stuff. But it definitely was like New York was its own place. It's its own provincial spot. It wasn't like now it's like everybody's from America and it's like come here because it's a fun thing. And I kind of thought after September 11th, not to be doom and gloom, but maybe that would scare some of these people away, these people. And in fact, it made it more of a champion, like, let's go there and be and help them rebuild, like, hey, some infomercial.
I worked at Paper Magazine at the time, and my boss, Kim Hastrider, like, we saw shit happen. We were, like, right down, we were downtown, you know? And she was just like, maybe this is what needs to happen right now. To clean it, and it was a very cynical way to look at it, but the truth of the matter is, you used to come here because we had what you didn't, right? And it was grit and dirt.
Well, you
and
were
truth.
Allowed to do things here that you weren't allowed to do in your small town USA, wherever you were from. You would come here to fly your freak flag,
right?
But I don't see any of those freak flags anymore. No. It's very strange. It's all baseball hats and cargo shorts now. You know,
well, everybody's kind of it's very similar. Everybody's the same, and you know, but stuff changes. And I guess maybe, you know, some other time and place, there's some other revolutionary culture going on where kids are shaking it up, and it isn't advised to grow a beard and look like the back of the Smith Brothers cough drop box. And you know,
okay, so I'm wearing cargo pants and I got a beard, so
it's all right, Spiro. I had a beard before I got here. I shaved, but you know, I'm trying to fit in. But it kind of is just like whatever, wherever you go, there you are, you do your bit. But I just feel like we came down here, we dealt with like the danger. Are you gonna get mugged? Or there's junkies, or there's this, or you know, and people are like, oh, Giuliani cleaned up the crime, and isn't that great? You know, your girlfriend doesn't get chased in Tompkins Square Park, but. You know, at the same time, you pay a price for that. You get it all clean and safe, and then you can't live there anymore.
Exactly.
Exactly. And then everybody's bringing what they want with them. And that's the part. Like, do the Little Wisco thing. I mean, that's insane.
Oh, yeah. Have you guys heard about that?
No.
The section of, like, where West 10th and West 4th meet in the Village. There's a guy there, Gabe Stuhlman. He owns some restaurants. And he's got a connection to Wisconsin, and he wanted to kind of rename the place Little Wisco. You know, and I just thought that took the biggest balls I had ever heard. You know, it's fucking Greenwich Village.
You can't have that.
If it was yours. Like someplace out in Canarsie or something, fine, take it. You know,
there's always weird things like that. I didn't hear that one, but I saw this other thing. I was walking by. I was like, oh, look, in Lily, there's a San Gennaro feast. Okay, here it is. It's here. You know, I don't really go. I don't eat the funnel cake anymore and the Zeppelis. I'm trying to be a little more vegetarian, but, you know, I don't know what's in that. And I'm like, all right, that's cool, the feast. And then the next day it says in the paper, Daily News, it says Scam Gennaro is the headline, and they realized just now it took them that the money isn't going to the church. Like, hello, scam. Like, maybe because the mob isn't down there and there's presence in the same way or something. But that was, I was like, really? This is, you're just figuring this
they
out?
Just
now.
Figured it out. They're not Scam Gennaro, like, secret.
God, but I don't know. I like being in New York still. I travel a lot, and I still find that, you know, there's things about Manhattan. There's an energy of walking out your door, and so many things happening. You know,
yeah. But the difference is the moment you put your foot out the door, you've already spent $20.
Yeah, that's true. But you got to have clever ways, you know, to find it. I still, you know, people. I've tried to live in Los Angeles. I've tried other things. I tell people I could still turn a trick here in my own way because, you know, I have a history and I know it, and you know, so, and I think maybe Danny feels the same. Way he's still here, but you know, we found ways because of our history, relationships with people, you know, just things we've learned, and so it's easier. But yeah, there's definitely times where
it's still New York. I mean, I'll come out of the subway and I look up and I look at, you know, the skyline the way some men look at a mountain range.
Sure. Yeah,
you know, that'll never change. The energy, you know, the vibrance of New York City, it's still the greatest city in the world.
Yeah, I mean, there's enough things. I mean, I have a really hard time with it, but there's enough things for me. You know, and I even think, like you were saying, you know, the skyline, the buildings, the parks, the museums, like they can't, I was going to say they can't change it. I guess they can try and they can fuck with it a little bit, but there are still things, you know, I have certain favorite things and some of them are still kind of untouched where if I don't look at you know, the schmucky people, I can kind of go back or go to a place that feels comfortable, you know, for me.
So what is left? What is left untouched?
I tried to figure this out because I was dating somebody who was a lot younger than me, and New York was like new for them, and they were excited. And I was like, all right, you know, I'm going to show you. It's like in that scene in Hannah and Her Sisters, the Woody Allen movie, where I think it's Sam Worthington. I don't know. He goes, let me go show you some of my favorite. He has the two girls he meets at the catering and drive around. They go look at his favorite buildings, and it's Woody's favorite buildings, you know, but all these great. There's that one by University Place they look at, that weird street. Anyway, so I had to think about this. And I was like, all right. Still go to Central Park. It's not so bad. I can go to the boathouse and get a drink and look at the water. I can go to Wohops, like Woody Allen says. Again, you want Chinese food at 3 in the morning? You want Tsing Tao for a dollar and get in a fight with some garbage men and cops and some Brooklyn guys? You know, you go to Wohop and there's nobody in there. There's no hipsters. It's all people from Staten Island.
You shouldn't say it. Yeah.
you know, I went to Coney Island the other day. The Cyclone was still there. The fat guy with the mean face with the lever wasn't there anymore with the pants up to his chest. But you know, it was still there.
Tie like this big, you know?
The Wonder Wheel's been there 98 years or whatever.
I took my son on that recently for the first time.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, you were there too.
Oh, yeah, I was taking pictures. Jimmy's Romanian is another one that I still love.
Sammy's
Romanian.
Yeah, that's the place. Jeremy Tepper.
Yeah, no, they would give you the vodka and a big block of ice and a big bucket of what do you call that again?
Schmaltz.
Oh my god,
love the schmaltz.
I would just drink it. It's
there's
amazing.
There's a bar in Times Square. There's nothing left. I guess Rudy's is probably still there in the west part. You know what? Near what they call Hell's Kitchen, but Jimmy's Corner on 45th
Street.
It's run by this ex corner man from the boxing days. He was Ali's corner man. Him and his wife run this place. They've been there since 75.
We know Jimmy for years.
That's there. You could walk in if you're stuck in Times Square and you want like a drink or hear some Charlie Parker on the jukebox. And usually the crowd is very neighborhood and still cool. The Subway Inn they want to close by Bloomingdale's, which is a cool spot. But that changed a little bit, but it's still there to see it. But
but in your neighborhood, you guys have Niagara, and now you've got Dream Baby.
You're known as the Bar Baron of the Bowery.
Well, a lot of these things I went to see. I would always say to people, like, you know, these different locations and how we're here, and I would say, you know, these places pick you. Yeah. And then recently I saw that Nick Cave movie, The 20,000 Days in Australia or whatever it is, and he says the same thing. And I started thinking about, because when we were little kids, me and Danny would come from different, well, all of us, before cell phones or anything, we'd find each other. I don't know how, but we all came from different areas. We didn't know each other, but we all found each other on a corner.
And we weren't afraid to use, like, you know, payphones.
Oh, no. And
like,
get
it was
shit
okay.
on your ear.
Yeah, exactly.
My friend's father had the number of all the payphones by Gem's Bob, and he'd be looking for his junkie son. He'd call every number and ask every bum on the street, "Fine, Paul." But so we all ended up down on 7th Street and Avenue A on the corner by Thompson Square Park. It was at the time A7, and the whole punk scene, hardcore scene, whatever it was going to be at the time, was like 60 people. And we all found each other because we needed to. And when there was something going on that night, you'd just go into the city. You'd ride the train. I'd find this guy. I'd find his friends. And we came from different spots, but we would end up, you know, knowing where each other was. And it was kind of, you had to like feel this radar of what was. Maybe you'd see a flyer, somebody wheat paste up with some piss and water onto a signpost and say, oh, 171A, and you'd have to, you know, it's like going on some kind of little mystery journey, pirate trail.
Yeah, but I mean, then there was the Wawa Hut and you guys
locations. So we used to hang at A7, we used to play there, leave there at 7 in the morning, you know, it was like this weird ass club, and then the King Tut's Wawa Hut in the more hairband piercing the 80s, days. I worked the door there when I was like 18, 19, and then one day, this friend of mine, Johnny T, says, you want to take this place with a couple other people and do this corner? And I said, I don't know. It's jinxed. You know, we did A7, and then Wally's was this place that burnt down, and that was a bomb. Like, why? Let's go somewhere on, like, Avenue C. And he's like, you don't want this corner? And I was like, he goes, come on, we'll burn. We'll get a rabbi in. We'll burn some incense. We'll get John Joseph. We'll do a prayer. We'll say some Rasta. And we took it, and what an idiot, you know, I was. And now it's like we've been there 17, 18 years. And it's funny because, you know, sometimes when me and Danny would be in there with a couple of other friends like Jimmy from Murphy's Law, Jimmy G, you know, a couple folks will come in and we'll make like, yeah, the bar was on this side and the door was over here. And, you know, back here, the guy who booked the band sold coke out of a Noxzema can. But we didn't know that because, you know, we didn't care. We wanted to just get on stage and plug in. There is that. And I like the history of places that you can go.
There's not much left. I mean, what's left over the pyramid is still there, but now it's a kind of a frat bar.
Pyramid. Yeah.
I used to be the doorman of the pyramid.
Pyramid seems just really different vibe.
Nah, it's the last G.G. Allin show after, right after he died, right? The last Murder Junkie show, I was the doorman at the Pyramid, and a bunch of these crusty kids from the Lower East Side, all of them underage, all of them reeking of you know, dust and diesel and just, you know, trying to get in. This kid Junkie Mike was the singer at the time, and this other kid Kevin 11 used to play with.
I know that guy.
Yeah, Kevin 11 was playing guitar at the time. They're all like, "Oh, we got to get in, we got to get in." I'm like, "I can't let you in." And this one little girl goes, "Well, what would Gigi Allen do if he was here?" I go, "He'd decompose." And all her friends went, "Ah, ha, ha."
That's the funny thing that you want to do, like that walk, or somebody once gave a tour, maybe it was Danny Fields, where things were, or this is where Jimi Hendrix lived, or this or that, and you know, I was thinking, well, that's where did Gigi Allen do the last gig? That gas station. Now it's like a Rite Aid.
Yeah,
it's exactly. That Rite Aid on 2nd and B.
Yeah.
But you know, there's so many things like that. I was in Papaya King on St. Mark's the other day. I was like, I was just wanted one of those stupid drinks, and I got the papaya thing. And in there on St. Mark's and 3rd, had this sign, I had to take a picture. It said, "Do you know," and in big letters, "that Lenny Bruce lived on this street and married a stripper?" And then I was like, "Really?" But he really lived on this street. And like, who goes into Papaya King? Some homeboy who gives a shit about Lenny Bruce living in St. Mark's place.
I do. Yeah.
So I took a picture of it and I Instagrawed it to Tim McGraw. And then he came back with Jimmy Webb and, you know, was on the world. You know,
I'm glad somebody has taste that they still remember who Lenny Bruce is. And you know,
they had a big sign. I got to show you on my phone. But
well, it's interesting the connection between. You know, between you having a restaurant and you have the bar Dream Baby, right?
Which is our old rehearsal space, which is funny.
Is it really?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was telling Spiro, like, that was when, I mean, almost, I think it almost goes back to when we were still in high school.
Before that, yeah.
But, yeah.
I was in,
I think we were like 15.
I was in junior high school.
Something crazy. And he got that space.
For the False Prophets was this band that had a rehearsal space there. And it was an old thrift store from like the 50s or 60s. It was next to Life Cafe. It was the only thing down there.
Yeah, Life was the only thing.
And False Prophets lived in this other room, which eventually became a Jamaican deli that sold funny cigarettes or whatever. And then the False Prophets asked Heart Attack, my band at the time, to share the room. So we came in, and then not long after that, Heart Attack broke up, and me and Danny formed the band Hope for a couple years, and we'd throw parties in there and rehearse in there. And I don't know where it went after that, how we ended up leaving there. I don't really remember, but it somehow became something else before it was Lakeside. Right?
Yeah, in about, I think, 87, 88, maybe.
Remember, we got paid not to rehearse by the people filming Fame.
Yeah.
We cut the deal.
Yeah.
And I was the first of, like, wow, they really want to come down here. It was before Madonna moved into, before Christa Dora House was open again.
Yep. Yeah, it's funny. Nick Martin from the Stimulators, you know, another great kind of infamous Lower East Side, East Village institution, you know, who we used to go see when we were like 13, 14, 15 years old. Nikki posted this thing the other day saying that whoever he was rehearsing with, and I don't even know what neighborhood, probably somewhere in that neighborhood still, but somebody knocked on the door and said, "Hey, you know, we're going to pay you to not rehearse because we're shooting a TV show or whatever." And Nick was so amazing. He was like, "Wow, this is so great. It could be so lucrative, you know." And I said, "Shit, you know, we were doing that like years and years and years ago. And we were talking about how much, you know, I think at the time, like it was just some ungodly amount of money to not rehearse. And, you know, it was great. I mean, we didn't have anything. So we said, sure, we'll take it."
And then sometime after that, it became, I don't know what, like someone else tried a gallery in there.
Yeah, a gallery and maybe like a junk shop, thrift store.
Yeah, another one of those kind of vintage things or something. And then Jim Marshall and Eric Roscoe got in there with Laura, who were still partners. She was the partner of Lakeside, and opened up Lakeside Lounge there. And that was, you know, then I moved around the corner, and that was just like the best place because you could see bands.
Oh, yeah.
And
Jesse lived right upstairs. Yeah, right on that
Steve
corner.
Earle playing there, and, you know, Gillian Welsh and David Rollins. I mean, and then crazy local bands and stuff. Bill Peitsch's band.
Sure, yeah, the Church Keys. Yeah, Jim Marshall, the Hound, he was a great DJ on, I think, what, on FMU? Yeah, and Roscoe, Eric Amble, those guys made that
place.
He was
in the Joan Jett Blackhearts. Yeah, so that was, you know, really cool, and that was going, and then when Laura was like, it's not going to happen there anymore, then suddenly me and Danny found ourselves back in there. And you know, people want to give you a lot of heat when things change. And I get it because, you know, I love the old stuff. And And, you know, you kind of get into it. When I opened up Coney Island High, I would go to these community board meetings, and they would look at us like, you know, this witch trials, like we were the gentrification. I'm like, well, I've played in bands since I was 12 in this neighborhood. I hired all musicians to work here. We're bringing people that love rock and roll onto St. Mark's Place, mm-hmm. where you sell records, T-shirts, and colored condoms. You know, we are bad. And they're like, yeah, you're changing the neighborhood, and you're ruining
everything.
And that
was such a much better time in comparison to now with the community
boards. Yeah, and it was so much worse shit going on the street, though.
Oh, absolutely.
And all, it was like a fucking some shooting gallery place across the street, and they were focused in on us, and they came down on us. This is an old story, and he's probably heard me tell it, but you know, Giuliani was mayor, and they started to enforce these quality of life rules,
yeah.
like, and this was
Which
you know no jaywalking,
go fuck yourself. I mean, yeah. basically that's all it is.
No brown bag. I mean, yeah. we played the garden. I got fucking cops on. You know, and so they decided to come after
broken
dancing.
Window theory.
Dancing.
Yeah.
So we got closed, Coney Island.
It's like Footloose
for dancing. Yeah.
Well, I mean,
yeah.
And the shitty part about that is the whole idea of cabaret laws were created initially to keep black people.
Yeah, it's
out
based
of,
and racism, yeah.
And then when it happened to Fat Baby, I think, where they had to have a big sign said, no dancing, please. And I talked to the manager there, and I'm like, well, what's dancing? He goes, according to the city, it's three steps in rhythm. I go, so if I really just walk really
right.
groovy,
yeah.
you're going to get arrested? It's like, you know. It's
well, I would say, what is it, two or more people acting, moving in an yeah. organized fashion. We could be like patty cake. And if we had a longer time, I'd tell a story about me going up against this consumer affairs guy, whatever, and him telling me that they were dancing and a power ballad was played and nobody was dancing. But we lost the club after 5 years.
That's why
years.
You lost Coney Island High.
That was the
club.
Well, because we stopped the dancing, and it hurt us because you make money with bands.
Right.
But the Green Door Party, when people can drink and dance yeah. and it doesn't have a beginning, middle, and end, and you're just a right. drunken idiot till 5 in the morning, people will drink. When the band's done, you go to Brownies or some club at Mercury Lounge, you leave. That's it. But if you're just dancing and drinking and the records keep going, you lose time, and you know the bar would do triple the amount.
Right.
So the combination is what works. That still is what works for us at Bowery Electric, is bands and then dance DJs in the combo. You know. Cool. So the place is now, they built on top of it. It's been gone for many years. Japanese place. We called Coney Island High Rise because it's been built. But all this stuff, you know, it's funny because me and him started writing songs again for Degeneration about maybe 2.5 years ago, maybe 3. And
you guys are going to do a reunion tour?
We did a tour. We're going to do a record finally.
A record, that's
yeah.
it.
Yeah. And we just started to think, what are we going to write about? And we wrote about the world that we exist in now globally, but we started with where we come from, all the stuff we're kind of talking about, but more in a direct, you know, way. There was a lot of Danny's idea, and a lot of the lyrics came from Danny this time. It was kind of, we switched roles a little bit, and a lot of what we're talking about and more is probably the direction of what, you know, just our history and our disgust with you know, the present day, and then what do we do because we're still in it and we still, this is all we know.
You're going to write a song called SantaCon?
Yeah, we should. Oh, shit. But it was
I'm
going to
join SantaCon.
It was good in that we got a lot out of, you know, there's a lot to say and there's a lot of feelings there, and, you know, it was a really good way to kind of, you know, it's a great subject. It's important to us.
Absolutely.
Know?
We should talk about that. We're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back, and I want to talk about the creativity of the East Village and Lower East Side and the restaurant and bar business. We'll
Absolutely.
Be back in a moment with Jesse Malin and Danny Sage.
To the battle, see him rattle, just excited when you wake up in the middle. Just can't. My name is Brandon Hoy, co-owner of Roberta's, a super duper awesome place. Roberta's is a very, 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 very proud sponsor of the Heritage Radio Network. We're also super awesome. Thank you, Heritage.
Hi, I'm Reggie Watts, and you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. Got Jesse Mallon and Danny Sage here. So, yeah, we were talking about the East Village, and even that, the East Village, like, years ago, it was all the Lower East Side. You know, like, East Village. It's
and then really weird people in the 80s start to call it Alphabet City. And we'll be like,
the movie, too. I mean, it was the Pacino.
No, but I always feel like when I hear that, I always, and I know guys that are older than me that come from the boroughs, and they'll argue with me about it. But I said this the other day to somebody. If somebody says to me Alphabet City, that always makes me think in my head they're not from here or they're really, really late. You know, like they got to the party way after the because I don't know, we never said that. I mean, I just, but maybe that's me, I don't know.
You have these different things that go like, all right, that's it. You know, I remember being like, all right, they took down the St. Mark's movie theater and they put like a pizza place there, and then there was a gap there 20 years ago. It was like, that's done. Kmart opened on Astor Place. I'm done.
7-Eleven.
And just keep now 7-Eleven on Avenue A by Hi-Fi and 11th Street. When the Starbucks took the little Ricky spot on the Hell's Angels corner, it was like, but it just keeps
Starbucks and little Starbucks and Hell's Angels go so well together.
Still there, and keeping it real. But I mean, you know, but the thing is, the last one was this one on 11th and A. That's 7-Eleven. It's so bright.
Yeah, it's crazy looking.
And there's no stopping it.
Now, we lost a lot of good places. I mean, there was downtown Beirut. There was Lismore Lounge. I mean, there was the Cat
Club. I used to play
the
Lismore Lounge all the time. It was always packed with Hell's Angels.
But you got to think that, you know, when I go through all this, and, you know, it's fun to look it up. I walked by the Mud Club one day, and they had a plaque outside. And I was like, well, that's kind of good they did that. But even before us, you know, because we're historians, we always wanted to know before there was Google, Wikipedia, whatever. Mm-hmm. We'd always want to know where everything came from, who produced what, who wrote what, who was the guy.
What was the scene? Yeah. Where was it happening?
And so, you know, we had guys saying, Trudy Hellers. We'd be like, I was the playroom. I saw the Bad Brains. Oh, it was Trudy Hellers. And then the Electric took us. And then on St. Mark's, there was, you're standing at the Dom. I'm like, who? Dom DeLuise? You know, it's like, we didn't know. But like, suddenly it would start to come back to us.
That was
like,
when there was liner notes. There's no more liner notes.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, there was.
There's none of that.
I mean, the one legacy me and Paul had when we were growing up was L'Amour.
Sure.
Which we call L'Amour's.
You
definitely get beat up there by a guy in a satin jacket.
Yeah, we probably got chased down the block there.
I got beat up by skinheads there, and Dr. No and HR fucking saved me when this asshole, Paul, that is, was getting like friendly with that guy from fucking Living Color.
I don't know. That sounds like we were having sex, the way you put it like that. We were getting friendly.
I got punched in the head by a bouncer and thrown out that back door at a Bad Brains gig, and it was late. It was like quickness. L'Amour's Brooklyn. It was a night HR had a Bible in his hand, and he decided
Holy
to do
shit,
the whole
the
show.
Same fucking night.
The whole must have been the whole show. He sang with the Bible and did all his moves. It wasn't like, oh, I got a Bible, I'm going to chill out and give you a different show. It was like full on flips, but he didn't let go of the Bible.
Color and 24/7 Spies.
Wow. Yeah,
I was at that show. I was at that
Holy
show.
Shit,
and
I got my ass kicked that show.
They grabbed me, punched me in the face, and then I'm out on the street, 67 whatever road, whatever it was, and the doors open.
Memories.
The left of the stage had these doors that flopped open, and you're right on the street. They didn't just, like, now they take you very nicely, you go over the railing, and they just put you back into the
pit. Yeah, exactly.
You know, and
those bounces were brutal.
Yeah.
We used to have these huge parties at my house when I was a kid. My brother was in a band, and he was 6 years older than me, and he would throw these huge parties, and all the bouncers would come back, and they'd all be stationed on the floor to keep people from wrecking my parents' house, but they were the nicest guys if you knew them in that environment.
Right.
But if you fucked around in the club,
sure,
that was it. You got treated like you got thrown out.
They live for, you know. But people got away with a lot of stuff like that. And in some ways, it's horrible. Like, oh, it's violent. But like years ago, in those days when we grew up, if someone had a fight in a bar, it was a bar fight. You went home. You're an idiot. You took your nose, you straightened it out.
Even in the 90s, when I was working at the Pyramid. You know, my job was to get assholes out of the fucking club. But even then, in the 90s, the Donnie, who owned that place and fucking like a gazillion other places, was like, nah, don't hit anybody. I'm like, what do you expect me to do? You know, like, well, how can I massage the situation? So, like, I'm like, let me buy you a drink. Come over here, and then I have to do like an arm lock or something and get you out.
See, I missed that whole thing. And actually, strangely enough, the night before I moved to New Orleans, I moved to New Orleans in 92. I went and saw Degeneration at the Continental.
Wow. Yeah, and still playing there then.
And then I left, and I was gone for the entire decade. I stayed in New Orleans the whole time, and I came back when it had already all been cleaned up.
Right.
But your stickers for your band remain, because when I met you, you know, a couple years ago, you told me the band Baby Strange, right?
Right, yeah.
And
yeah.
I said, I know the band because the stickers were all over Connell, so you left enough stickers to stay.
Yeah, we played there a lot. We put enough stickers to leave a memory.
I actually did that logo.
But you did the logo, yeah.
The Continental, I think, there's different things I think that taught me and Danny about the bar business and stuff. I mean, obviously, before we had a record deal with D-Generation, mm-hmm. we used to always say we wanted to get a bar deal. Mm-hmm. We wanted to be able to drink free in every bar in the Lower East Side, East, whatever you want to call it. And we achieved that. We felt we were very triggered at that.
Yeah, then we met Trigger. So
living the dream.
And at Continental, Trigger was the owner, and he had a club in Midtown, a restaurant called the Film Center Cafe. Great place. Yep. And he was involved in that place so much and out of town that he let our pal Roger Davis run the Continental. And we were packing it, and the place was making money. I don't think he knew how or what was happening, or he did to some extent. And in other ways, I always felt like he was like some dad that kept a blind eye, like if we burned the place down. The kids were having fun, and it was muddy in the drawer. But he let it happen in the drawer. And we would go crazy in there. We would stack tables to the sky, light everything on fire, break glasses, have sex on the stage at 6 in the morning with the strobe light. Like, try everything. Our guitar player, Rick, would breathe Bacardi 151 rum and spray it all over the place. And so we'd live there. We'd make the mixed cassette tapes. And the bartenders would be like, come on, back here. Make a drink. And so Danny became the bartender. I became the cassette tape, comp mixtape guy. And little by little, we learned, like, oh, this is how you kind of throw a party. And then
this is how you don't operate a bar.
let me ask you that question in regards to what it was like when you opened Niagara to now with the new place, right? I mean, back then it was still a cash business to some level. I mean, and now every last fucking penny is accountable. It's
and everybody's out to cancel their card, or they get drunk and forget that they screwed something up, or they want to pretend they didn't. Everyone's father's a lawyer. Everyone has a case. Nobody just goes home and go, you know what? I was a drunk idiot. You leave your cell phone. They call you up. They're calling the cops. Or the cops call us. We have 10 reports of lost cell phones. If I lost something years ago in a cab, I'm like, I'm a drunken idiot. I got to deal with it.
Let's explore that. You actually get assholes who call you about their lost cell phones?
Well, they'll call the cops.
Yeah. They'll call the cops about their lost fucking cell phone?
And then it's called a larceny. The cops call that a larceny. So
what?
They'll come around and say you have 10 claims or 10 whatever it is, complaints of larceny.
They put it against
50.
The bar?
Yeah, and then they start to come and look for trouble at your place, and then they'll find some other thing that, you know, whatever, and find a way. But if you stay off that list, you're okay. But you can't control it by having these people who feel very entitled and don't know how to drink, and they have a couple fireballs, and they're like, you know, their cell phone disappears. And there are people, though, in this day that are preying on the bars. There are groups of people that are coming in and are pickpocketing, especially in the winter and fall months, that go in.
Jackets.
And they know when they go
it's
into
the seasonal
purses.
Seasonal
and these people
pickpocketing.
Have no fucking idea because they think it's Candyland. They're like dancing to, you know, something, and they leave their bags and coats everywhere like they're at their grandparents' house. And these guys come in and they don't look like thugs. Sometimes it's women, and they use the texting to be like, okay, go over there. Like, they have a whole system. And they'll come in, and if they know they can get away with it, they'll keep hitting your bar.
Now I hate
this should be a 2020 expose.
No, I hate the fact that you're suffering for that. But I like the fact that it exists.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not suffering from anything. I'm okay.
Now, you know what I'm saying. In other words, I don't want your bar to be heard from it. But, I mean, at the same time, I'm like, it's still there. Like what we were talking about in the beginning, it's still there. It's still a hustle in New York, right? And it's still under the freaking table.
Oh,
when
it definitely happens.
And then you get cameras, you know, and that's some things that people didn't have. And the other day, you know, you used to have to distrust people and know that everybody was stealing from you, and you went with it. It was like part of it still is in a business like that. More.
Yeah, but, I mean, the cameras only do so much. I mean, you know, you guys know Otto Schmuckenhead, right?
My friend
Steve, who he's been on
Steve.
The show. Yeah,
great guy.
Steve has a photo booth, if you've ever been in there, right? Now, Steve had just outfitted the whole fucking place with cameras, and someone took a dump in the photo booth. Couldn't find it. They like, there was the one place they couldn't angle, like, who the fuck took the dump in the photo booth, right? But the fun part was, like, afterwards, it's like, hey, let's go to Otto's. What, shits and giggles? You want to take a photo? No, they come out crappy.
I'm glad we don't have a photo booth anymore.
Yeah, I thought all that stuff has faded. How do you guys feel being in the bar and restaurant business, and being in the rock and roll business, first and foremost? that now they refer to chefs as rock stars more than actual
well,
rock stars.
When I met you, I realized that.
Yeah, I'm an exception.
After seeing Johansson on the show in Staten Island eating Twinkies in a restaurant in a strip mall with Mario Batali or Sammy Yaffa, I don't know. Yeah, it's that they said that's the
Yaffa
new rock
was on the show with Bourdain. Bourdain, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
They cut him up a little. Right?
You know, Bourdain used to take care of us, though. I will say, when we that what was the first place on Park Avenue?
La Halle,
yeah. I don't even remember the hookup or who it was, but somebody, and we used to go there, and I went there by accident, but it was right in the beginning of Degeneration when, you know, we were kind of known downtown, but, you know, we didn't have like a nickel between the five of us. Like, and if it wasn't for certain places like Angelica right. Kitchen, you know, Leal, right. God, I can't, he would remember, but. You know, they would take such good care of us. And at first it was shocking. You know, it was like, shit, I didn't even know where this was coming
from.
That
was an old New York tradition, though. I mean, Odeon, how many rock stars? How many?
Maxes,
how many,
we heard they
Maxes,
gave people
I mean, how many people did they feed?
Free chickpeas, steak and lobster.
And barter stuff, like Max's, the Chelsea Hotel. Yeah. You can't go to the Chelsea now. Chris Stein just had an exhibit of Blondie and all kinds of rock and roll photos. It's not even in the Chelsea. It's like three doors down. My favorite band. But then it's it's actually...
You got to be quick.
Yeah, you got to be quick then.
I'm used to it.
It's actually, you know, like that guy Stanley Bard. They got him out. They made it to some kind of condo, so you got to buy in. And it's not like, you know, that all these places, they change up. But there was this spirit of like you could trade... art, or if you're playing our place, you could drink, or you can eat here, you know, and try to have that. And
yeah,
even at Coney Island High, one of our partners owned a chain called Burritoville.
So I used to love Burritoville.
And we used to give bands, the guy would hand out these tickets to go to Burritoville and gas you up for a show. And
that was Tribeca.
Well, no, there was one at Second Avenue.
Yeah, there was one at Second Avenue.
And there was one in Little Wisconsin.
He had about 11 of them, and then he sold on the up, and they got out. But, you know, that was the funny thing.
I think the thing that's different about then, and kind of what we were saying before about, like, how people would come here to fly their freak flag and all that, there was a smaller group of people who would come here. And like you said about everybody would find each other, even though there were no cell phones or everything. You know, like... If you wanted to be an artist or a writer or a musician, it seemed like the community, that community, was a lot smaller than it is now. You know, it's not as prevalent. Like, you used to be able to go to one corner and you could spot somebody, you know, who was like you. But now it's like, who are we looking for? You know, brand builders? You're looking for somebody with a laptop under their arm or something? You know,
there's a lack of a hustle. There's no hustle.
But there's no style. Everybody looks the same. The energy's different, you know, and everybody's pretty. We'd have to go to L.A. to see beautiful girls. You saw, this is how much the downtown area would be. Like, when we were in D-Gen, you know, we thought we were pretty hot shit. You know, we were full of our thing and all. But below 14th Street, if we saw one pretty girl that we didn't know, we would have to figure out who it was. If not, some guy we'd find out was dating her. Your friend was dating her. There wasn't a chance that it was just going to be some random thing. Like, it would be so rare. Now, I couldn't walk down, you know, 7th Street and try to count how many beautiful girls. It would be, there would be 50 within, you know, 20 minutes.
It's like L.A. You can't swing the proverbial dead cat without hitting three of them. But the thing about New York, I think,
and good-looking guys, too, not to leave out the you know.
You know, about, like,
sex.
Art and that change or whatever. I think, like, you know, in the hustle, these kids, I mean, I hate sounding like this, but I think a lot of these people.
The kids today.
Yeah, I just think a lot of these people weren't brought up with having to hustle, so why? Yeah. What are they going to all of a sudden start when they're 25?
They say that our generation is the hardest working and most adaptable.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well,
but,
no, because
no, I'm teasing.
Because a lot, like, you know, the greatest generation gets a lot of press for being the greatest generation, obviously. And then you have the silent generation, and you have the baby boomers,
but
and millennials.
But the 90s is the last great generation.
But Generation X, I mean, we had things that other people didn't. You know, like, you know, World War One or Two, that's one thing. You have a bomb going off in your face or somebody shooting at you, that's one thing. But we had more... more subversive kinds of things coming at us. We had AIDS. We had financial crisis. We had a lot of things that no generation before us had ever dealt with. We had to be adaptable.
That's the thing. I mean, look.
Cold waiting. I had cold waiting.
Yeah, well, I mean, no, listen, I'm a high school dropout. If I didn't learn how to use freaking a computer in the 90s, I never would have had a fucking job. Right. You know, and now I work with people who, you know, who are all college graduates. I never bothered. But the reason was I hustled into a situation that it was a very subversive situation. It was this company called Sudo, right? That did all these crazy parties, and they were all about, like, you know, when I first worked there, I was like, what the fuck is email? What the fuck is the web? I have no fucking clue. But because I was able to see a situation, get into it, see there was music involved, there was art involved, there was this new way, this new delivery system involved, I was like, fuck it. You know, this is where I want to be. And honestly, if I didn't do that, you know, I don't have any skills like him.
Yeah, but I was I put my resourcefulness to being heroin addict.
Well, yeah, I know, but you can cook. I mean, that was
the
thing.
You survived past that, so yeah.
Yeah, I survived it.
And it's all like a lesson. It's all a thing, a path. But, you know, if you figure we came from a place where we had to be creative. I didn't barely go to high school, but, you know, figure out ways to survive. You know,
exactly.
Even when we were trying to get by, when it wasn't that expensive to live in New York and we were drinking free, we still had to eat and stuff. We'd go up to the record companies and we'd tell them we loved, you know, Barry Manilow and Jethro Tull, and to give us promotional copies that we were studying the music, or we might want to be with their label, or maybe we'd fill up these fucking envelopes, and then that wasn't bad enough that we'd get a large envelope full of stuff, but then you'd be great because you could sell that. You'd be set for like a couple days, but you'd have to beat the other member of the band down before he got there, and the guy said, I already got two Jethro Tull live albums from 92, you know, and so we'd have to be like, yeah, and then try to get in the train and be the first one to arrive on St. Mark's and sell the shit.
Yeah.
But
how do you guys feel about all the critical things as far as like Yelp and stuff like that? Like, you guys were always known for being critically acclaimed.
Yeah.
You know, even
yeah.
your solo stuff.
If we had if we had good reviews,
it wasn't a food
worth something, we'd be rich. But yeah, I mean I dig, you know, I mean, like, we, you know, when we did Irving a couple of years ago, and it was a great gig, and it was right when we came back from Europe, and it was a big deal.
Who's Irving?
Irving Plaza, for those people.
I let that one slide. I was going to jump on that.
Irving Plaza is it's one of the last venues that's still, I think they tried to change it, and they just went right back to what it always was. So, but we played there, and... Sure. You know, it was a really big deal. It was a great show. It was meant a lot to us on a personal level, too. But then, you know, talking about reviews, we got this great review from David Frick in Rolling Stone. And it was like, you try to think like, well, that doesn't mean a lot to you, or you don't want it, you know, because you get bad reviews, too. But you know what? It's meaningful. So it's cool. And then even, you know, with the bars and stuff, or, you know, like with me with Dream Baby, I mean, you know, I pay a little bit of attention to it, but for me, I can't sweat it too bad, but I do like it when people like what I'm doing. I mean, I'm not going to lie and say I don't give a shit. I give a shit to a point. You can't lose sleep over it, but, you know, I do, you know, when I'm there, if I have, like, some, you know, girl come up to me and say, oh, you know, I had my birthday party here, and it was amazing, and I had such a good time. I mean, how can you not, you'd have to not be human to not be proud of that and happy
Absolutely.
With that.
Absolutely. Well, it's like, you know, playing music or anything that makes somebody happy.
Yeah.
You know, and music and food and drink and all that stuff, you know, they're all very noble tasks.
Sure, yeah. And I think you're touching people. I mean, you know, it's something that he and I probably, in a way, we didn't put that much time and energy. There's certainly people that do.
I get the feeling
more.
You guys put a lot of time and energy into touching people.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, you can have. We're not having any callers, right? But yeah, I mean, I think like. Well, you know, I'm proud of it, and I like that people have a good time. I mean, we do, you know, we had a wedding a couple of weeks ago, and the people were so, you know, it was like it was a part of their life and their wedding. And, you know, I mean, it's, I don't know, like, I was really happy. It's
Absolutely.
Like one day out of their lives, and they picked to do it at our place. And I don't know, and they had a great time. I think that's pretty cool. You
Absolutely.
Know?
Let me ask you guys a little bit about road food.
Oh, God.
We were talking about this with our old producer, Orla, and she did a lot of work on the road, and we had Mini Kiss on last week, the manager of Mini Kiss, and we were talking about different road food and everything. What was the best or the worst road experience you guys ever had?
I think he has a harder time than I do. Jesse has a harder time than me because he's a vegan. I'll eat crap, you know, like I'll eat bacon and eggs every day.
He's a vegan. Yeah. What do you do in the airport? What?
I jump around, yell things. Now, everything's changed. Act like
he does.
Tourist.
It's getting a lot better now, especially in airports.
No, I mean, you can get salads everywhere now. Like, when I first started touring in Heart Attack, the hardcore band, in early D-Generation days, yeah, nobody knew, like, you know, vegetarian, like, forget it. Now the V word is like, I think John Joseph says, I don't use used the V word. He's plant-based organic because it's become, you know, we used to have to maybe find a supermarket that had veggie burgers. It was before Boca Burgers. You get some dried crap thing. But Europe was always a little hip to vegetarian stuff, even though maybe not Germany, but like certain parts of definitely England. And, you know, you find ways to do stuff, but you don't want to just like be a vegetarian and not just eat meat and then eat like all like pasta
French
and
fries
carbs
and Doritos.
Yeah. So, but the world's changed so much because bands are real extreme. They've had it on their rider before. Ray Capo and Shelter were doing it and, you know, whatever. But I think that if you still have to be smart, and for a while I was going to write like a blog or a book or something about like vegetarian restaurants in different cities because, you know, before the technology, I'd have to just walk and ask people, and I still don't know how to use the technology, the thing as Danny calls the Google box or whatever. So I don't get on my phone. I'll just go ask some girl like or some guy like, hey, you're going to Rex, or where's like the, and then I find like in Liverpool, you know, the vegan Angelica's Kitchen of there, and then it becomes like part of my day, and I get to walk around the city and see what's going on. So some of those little exploring little trail things give you an idea of something to talk about at the show with the audience. You feel like you're not just sitting in the room going, all right, order up the burger and the fries and, you know, whatever, run to McDonald's. You're learning something about a town and you have to do the work like we did when we had to find the Village. You know, we didn't get on the train. Where do you go downtown? Where do you get those jackets and the records with the 45s with the PIL? What is that?
You know? It's interesting you mentioned John Joseph. Last time I was backstage at a Cro-Mags concert, they found out that I was a chef. And the next thing, we were discussing all kinds of different recipes and like, well, how do you make this and how do you make that? And it just became like, you know, like it wasn't backstage at CBGB's anymore with a bunch of people like, you know, with bloody noses. Right. It was a very surreal experience of discussing vegan cuisine. And,
right. Oh, he's
and
big.
The
I
best
sat in
way
the park.
To slice cabbage.
I remember him and Harley stealing from Prana Foods and us sitting in Times Square Park and John cooked up some amazing thing on a park bench. And I was like, all right, you know, squatter cuisine. Yeah. But I think there's things me and Danny like, too, with traveling on a good note, not being, like, all struggled out about it, is, like, you know, we go to L.A., there's a certain burrito spot that we heard about from Joe Strummer, and it was in, like, a trailer like this side of the Pantages Theater. Right. It's still there. It just moved across the street called Dos Burritos. It's terribly cheap and open all night and dirty and greasy and vegetarian, too.
We love it.
And it's like, we have to stop there. You know, we go to Astroburg. Like, there's certain things that we have in cities that are, like, got to go there. Bubba's Roadside Barbecue in Dallas, Houston, Junction. All right, I'm shutting up.
What do you get at Bubba's Roadside Barbecue?
I watch them eat and get all happy. 8x10.
Our engineer is losing our shit on me. So anyway.
You guys have anything you want to plug before we go? Yeah. Talk about your restaurants, your bars.
Well, you know, we have Jesse has a couple. We have together, we have Dream Baby on Avenue B. It's 162 Avenue B. We're going to both, I guess, him solo and us together, we're going to have at least probably two new records out next year. We have the new D-Gen record, and I think he's going to have a solo record, and you can look at, I think, what is it, degeneration.us? I think that's it. So that'll kind of keep you posted. We have the Facebook and all that junk.
Nice. You got Bowery Electric, you got Black Market, Niagara, Dream Baby.
Yeah, that's enough.
That's enough for now.
All right, folks. We're done.
Yeah, thank you guys very much for joining us tonight.
It was a lot
of
fun.
Yeah,
awesome.
You.
Thanks so much, guys.
Peace. See you all next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archive programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions anytime at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a 501c3 nonprofit. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.